This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. In 2018, the journalist Kevin Williamson was hired away from the flagship publication for the conservative movement, National Review, by one of the oldest and most prestigious magazines in American history, The Atlantic. The editor of The Atlantic explained that Williamson's hire was done to help bring ideological diversity to the pages of a publication that skewed reliably liberal or left-wing on most things. Williamson's first piece for The Atlantic, a column declaring that the libertarian moment heralded by Reason was deader than a doornail, appeared on April 2nd. He was fired 3 days later, after a years-old tweet had come to light, one in which the pro-life Williamson argued that women who have abortions should not only be charged with homicide, but executed, preferably by hanging. Worth pointing out that Williamson was joking, at least about the hanging part, because he's generally against capital punishment. Williamson eventually rejoined the staff of National Review, where he continues to author a mix of heavily reported articles from the backroads of America and opinion pieces that are always incredibly well-written and I find very challenging to libertarian sensibilities, many of which the 46-year-old Texan shares. He's also just published The Smallest Minority, Independent Thinking in the Age of Mob Politics, which he had actually started writing before he got fired by The Atlantic. I spoke with Williamson at Freedom Fest, the annual gathering of libertarians in Las Vegas, about his brief, tumultuous experience at The Atlantic, why he thinks Trump supporters are often just as bad as left-wing ideologues when it comes to shutting down divergent opinions, and how America might actually start encouraging people to think for ourselves again. Kevin Williamson, thanks for talking to Reason.
Always a pleasure.
So in your new book, The Smallest Minority, Independent Thinking in the Age of Mob Politics, you come out in favor of individualism in an age of mobocracy. Or what is the technical term you have for a mob rule?
I think it's pronounced oaklocracy.
Okay, yeah. I didn't know how to pronounce it.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you read things, but you've never said them out loud, and you're nervous the first time you say it because you're not sure you're saying it right. I think I just had one of those.
That's like an everyday anxiety for me. Yeah. But give the elevator pitch.
The elevator pitch. Well, you know, we're here in Las Vegas, which is the most American of all American cities. And I was in my hotel room in the shower, and there's a bottle of shampoo in there. And it's a pretty nice hotel, you know, and it's a kind of fancy brand of shampoo. And on the back of the bottle, it says, for external use only. So in a world in which there's probably good reason for telling people that they can't drink shampoo, can you really trust large groups of people acting in concert and inspired by rage and resentment and terror? And I tend to think no.
And one of the other terms, and this one I definitely can't pronounce, it's a German term that's big to the book, is a straight bar democracy?
Yeah. Or what? Militant democracy is the English version of that term. It's just more fun to write it in German.
I'm sorry, what?
Militant democracy.
Militant democracy.
Battlesome is sometimes translated that way, but battlesome is a pretty cumbrous adjective. This is an idea that goes back to the immediate post-war era. It's associated with a writer named Karl Lowenstein, who was a German refugee. And militant democracy is the idea that liberal democracies sometimes must behave in ways that are anti-democratic and illiberal in order to save themselves from basic fundamental threats to liberalism and democracy.
And the idea of this is essential. It's coming out of the fact that a German democratic system produced Nazis.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. So this is in the immediate post-war era, and during the war itself, I suppose, the idea really starts to come for the war. There is the idea that governments should occasionally do things like prohibit certain kinds of political parties or suppress certain kinds of political speech or organizing in order to save democracy from basic existential threats. Mm. And that is the current operating theory under which countries like Germany and Austria prohibit certain kinds of books or prohibit certain kinds of political parties and political activism in a way that we wouldn't really find acceptable in the United States, I think. But we're increasingly, I think, finding that sort of thing acceptable. And by convincing ourselves that we are constantly on the verge of some sort of existential crisis, we give ourselves an excuse to engage in that sort of oppressive and suppressive behavior. And so every time there's a Charlottesville or there's an Antifa act of violence somewhere on both sides of the political spectrum, although I tend to think right now more strongly on the left, you get this opportunism where people want to take these sorts of episodes and use them as an excuse for saying, well, we have to prohibit this, we have to prohibit that, mm-hmm. We can't allow this kind of speech and that kind of speech. And then it becomes much more generally, much more vague, and this is where the kind of social media mob phenomenon comes in, where if Scarlett Johansson is allowed to play a transgender person in a historical film, it somehow is going to cause some sort of harm or actual violence to transgender people in the world, and therefore these things must be prohibited. And you end up with this kind of mass hysteria and culture of just really prone conformism.
Yeah, the book is it's wonderfully written. It is it opens, you know, where you're discussing monkeys in India masturbating and flinging poo at people. And
yeah.
I want to point out this is a Regnery book. So this is from a conservative imprint. It's certainly the most foul-mouthed book, I'm assuming, that Regnery has published, unless they
probably
did 50 Shades of Grey or something.
Yeah.
It's a defense of individualism and nonconformity.
Yeah.
Against both whether right wing and left wing. What is going on? Because none of the trends that you're talking about are new, but
exactly.
They are more, you're arguing that they're more extreme.
Yeah. Well, maybe not more extreme. I mean, if you think of the Wilson era, where you had the government sending out, you know, teams of black shirts to beat up newspaper editors and jailing war protesters and that sort of thing. So we always tell ourselves these are the worst of all possible times, and that things have never been this bad. Things have been this bad before. I mean, I don't think things are as bad politically right now as they were in the 1960s, much less the 1860s. So not to get hysterical and panicked about things. I think that a couple of social trends have contributed to this. One is social media, which is just sort of, by its nature, it rewards anger and outrage and displays of emotion rather than civility and exchange and that sort of thing. And it's also fun because it gives people who aren't normally involved in politics or in media a kind of taste of the power that's involved in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a leveling phenomenon, right? And you talk about that, about how people who are, you know, relatively anonymous or might have small Twitter followings but are able to generate a huge outrage or start a conversation.
Yeah.
Clear, that's not a bad thing, right? In and of itself.
Not a good thing. I mean, it's a thing, right? Yeah. So social media is not the problem. And social media doesn't make people dumb and angry. It just reveals that people are dumb and angry.
Right.
And it helps them broadcast their stupidity and anger to the world more efficiently. So it also, you know, I mean, also enables great things, of course. I mean, both of our magazines, for instance, have much larger reaches now than they used to, thanks to digital publishing. And it's easier to engage in useful and fruitful communication than it used to be. But it's also easier to engage in stupidity. And this thing I call anti-discourse, which is, it's communication, but it's communication that is intended to discourage or prevent the exchange of views and information and ideas, which is what you get a lot of. So someone says, well, I think that we should change the tax rate from 39% to 34%. And 10,000 other people say, well, you're a neo-Nazi because you believe that. And then you can't really have the
then
discussion.
Then you point out that Hitler was anti-smoking. So really, you know, different conversation.
It's all exactly the same thing, right? Yeah, so that's that part of that book. There's a lot of, you know, funny, angry, cultural stuff in there, but there's also some slightly more serious discussions.
Well, and, you know, let's talk, I mean, this is both serious and funny, and you yourself were, a very high-profile victim of a kind of online mob revenge.
Yeah,
right?
I like that word victim. A couple of things about that. One is
and explain what happened.
Sure, yeah, I'll get to that in a second. I hate talking about it. It's so boring.
You hate talking about it, and yet you wrote a book in which you devote several chapters and a lot of swipes to this.
Right, yeah. I mean, got to pay the bills, right? So, well, that's the funny thing about the book is I started writing this book a year before I went to work for The Atlantic, and because I was interested in this phenomenon as it applied to other people. And I wasn't surprised when, after The Atlantic hired me, that this sort of outrage social media mob formed. In fact, I told the editor there that this was going to happen.
And you were explicitly hired because they wanted to bring intellectual or ideological diversity to The Atlantic.
Right, yeah, but just not that much.
Right.
Know. So The Atlantic's problem was that, they hired me really not for my column writing and commentary, but really more for my reporting, the stuff I've written about, you know, Appalachian poverty and opioid addiction and other stuff that I've written quite a bit about. And that's sort of what they wanted me to work on, more reporting type stuff along those lines. Their problem was they wanted someone to cover rednecks, and they screwed up and hired one. And it was bad cultural fit for them, I think. And, you know, I'm not to, you know, there's a sort of thing among conservatives to sneer at conservatives who work at places like the New York Times. And I dislike that tendency among my ideological brethren, but I'm a very different sort of person than Ross Douthat is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, someone like Ross would, you know, maybe fit in more at a place like that than I would. So it's largely about, it's really more about me than it was about the things I'd written in the past. If it hadn't been the abortion stuff, it would have been transgender stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, the proximate, so you, to some fanfare, and your reporting from Appalachia and other places, really spectacular. And I think part of it is because it's informed that you're not reporting on people who you look at from a helicopter or something like that. These are people that you know on some level, or you come from a similar milieu, a more working class, or if you want to call it redneck, hillbilly, whatever. But you wrote, or in the past, you had said things about we should treat abortion like every other homicide, and then filled those comments out by saying that, you know, women and doctors and women who are participating in them should be executed for murder, and that was the thing that seemed to start everything rolling, right?
Yeah. It wasn't that at first, actually. Mm-hmm. At first, it was stuff I'd written about transgender issues and a column I'd written about Laverne Cox and some of that stuff. So yeah, it was a conflation of two sort of separate conversations. One is about if we do prohibit abortion, which I think that we should do, how do we go about doing that? There's a tendency, I think, among people who are pro-life to try to avoid that question because making something illegal means what it means.
Right.
And so, well, we don't want to punish people for it. Well, how do you
outlaw something? The standard pro-life line is that the woman who gets the abortion is the second victim of the abortion. And we shouldn't hold her accountable for something that she is the primary cause of.
Right, yeah, as though women were somehow morally deficient and unable to be accountable for their actions. And, unfortunately, among women who commit homicides, there's a non-trivial number who kill their children. Mm-hmm. As newborns or as young children, and we don't treat that as though they're not morally accountable for it. The other part of the conversation is that, as you may or may not know, I'm opposed to capital punishment and have been for a long time in most cases. I mean, in principle, I guess I can imagine cases in which it might be advisable, although it's really hard to come up with one. But one of the things I especially dislike about capital punishment, the way it's currently practiced, is this bizarre medicalization of it, this weird clinical thing we do where we bring in doctors and we treat it like it's a medical procedure.
Although they're not actually doctors, right? They're because doctors can't perform lethal injection.
Are they not actually doctors?
Yeah, which is one of the reasons they're not even that, which is why they screw it up all the time, because they can't actually get professionals to do it.
Oh, man, I I was not actually aware of that. Learn something new every day. So I've often argued that if we are going to have capital punishment, then the state should be honest about what it's doing, and that sentences should be carried out in some forthrightly violent manner. Hanging's a traditional one, firing squads, whatever.
I hate to sound it, but you sound like Michel Foucault now, because this is the premise of discipline and punish, that in modern society we kind of clean up everything and hide it behind a patina of civilization and rationality. Well, I mean, what you're calling for
are public
hangings.
Well, I went to school in the 90s, man, so I've had a lot of Michel Foucault in my life, and you were mentioning Derrida earlier.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, I ran into in India once, I guess. He was doing a talk there. He must have been quite old at that time. Yeah, well, I think there's something to that. That's the point.
Well, but I mean, to bring it back to the book, so you get hired by The Atlantic. People are a little bit uncomfortable with it to begin with, because who is this right-wing guy?
Yeah.
And then stuff, you're very skeptical or critical of transgender people or the transgender identity, or you have said things about, you know, about abortion that clearly are not going to play well with The Atlantic readership or editorialship. And so then what happens? Like, how long were you actually working at The Atlantic?
I think I was technically an employee for maybe a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. I was actually in the office. I think it was 3 days. So I did write a piece.
Was it again?
It's the piece I write every other year about how no one likes libertarianism.
Right.
And it's my anti-Nicolas piece.
Thank you. I don't know why I forgot.
Yeah, I got to write that fairly often, you know, every now and then. So
back to the line. There's a lot of that coming on.
The funny thing about the Atlantic situation was, so there's this big social media outrage thing, and couple of 100,000 tweets and that sort of thing. I think there were maybe 9 articles in the New York Times or something like that. None of that really had anything to do with my getting fired. Mm-hmm. Their decision to fire me was really based on internal staff stuff mm-hmm. of a small number of staffers right. who just were not going to be ever able to make peace with the fact that I was working there. So in the language of American labor law, it was a hostile work environment, which they solved by firing me.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about those internal dynamics? Jeffrey Goldberg, who was the editor who hired you and uh-huh. fired you, does not come off well. How did he inform you? Explain why you think he's a bad actor in this.
Yeah. I'm pretty easy on Jeff in most ways because I think he's a pretty good editor and he's a good journalist. And I think he made a wrong decision in my case, but every editor I've ever worked with has made a wrong decision mm-hmm. about something, including me when I was, editor of a few publications in the past. And so editors, every now and then screw something up. I knew I was going to get fired when he invited me to breakfast because the last time I got fired over breakfast. So when mm-hmm. people invite me to breakfast, if they're people who sign
it is the most important meal of the day.
It is the most important meal of the day. And apparently that's when you fire people, I guess. So, yeah, it's funny because the Atlantic's based in the Watergate building, mm-hmm. which is, of course, always hilarious for a right-winger to be there in the first place. You just kind of want to sneak around through the parking garage. And Jeff, actually, he kind of is a little bit of a scholar of the mm-hmm. building and like can show you which is the door where they put the tape to mm-hmm. Get through and do the burglary and all that. So, I think he's like a lot of men in his position. He's acutely aware of being a middle-aged or more heterosexual white male mm-hmm. in an industry that would like to have fewer of those in positions of power, I think. And although he's on the left politically, he's probably to the right of where most of his magazine is and a lot of progressive media is in to the extent that he's traditionally very pro-Israel and mm-hmm. In favor
he's a
of
hawk
relatively strong yep. national defense mm-hmm. policy and that kind of thing. And so he's got some pressure on him already for that. And I think it was just he overestimated his own and his institution's ability to stand up to the kind of pressure under which they were sure to come.
So, well, let's talk about it more generally. I mean, the idea of mob rule, and you write at one point, I guess you're quoting from Isaiah Berlin, who said that the essence of liberty is the right to resist, to be unpopular.
Yeah.
I mean, the book is a pay into the idea that that's getting harder and harder to
sure,
do.
Sure, yeah.
You say social media amplifies that, but it's not the primary cause. What are the primary causes in the increase in the difficulty of being an individual as opposed to a member of a gang or a tribe or a group?
So one thing you said earlier that I just think about for a second, when you describe me as a victim of this, I don't like that language very much, because this isn't mainly about people like me. People mm-hmm. like me who are in the controversy business, this is not a new thing for us. It's just an occupational mm-hmm. hazard. And life goes on for people like me. I get fired by The Atlantic. I write an essay about it in The Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. Life goes on. We are not silenced for the most part or anything like that. Where it's a real problem is for people who are not professionally mm-hmm. in that sort of business, who are Starbucks managers in Philadelphia, who are losing their jobs for trying to enforce company policies according to their own rules, or guys who are losing their, jobs making burritos at Mojo Burrito, mm-hmm. which I just laugh every time I say Mojo Burrito and the powers that be at Mojo Burrito, because they've got political views that are bad, certainly, but also unpopular. And of course, people aren't being fired for views that are bad. They're being fired for views that are unpopular. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're the same thing, but that's not the reason. So Eric Fromm, who I quote a lot in this, was a Marxist, Freudian social analyst, and a really interesting guy. And he and Hayek came to very similar conclusions mm-hmm. about the state of the world in the middle of the 20th century, which was that the rise of salaried corporate employment as a kind of social norm was bound to breed a culture of conformism and homogeneity right. and lack of intellectual enterprise.
This is one of the most fascinating things about the book, mm-hmm. which I wanted. That's
we'll get
that's
to that
my
next.
Note. Well, no, I just that from particularly for a conservative libertarian type writer, Eric Fromm, Friedrich Hayek, and William White. And we'll talk about him in a second, the guy who wrote a book called The Organization Man. But to see Fromm and Hayek mixed up. So talk about
Trotsky
their critique of the large kind of organization as antithetical to individualism.
So Fromm's theory, and he was a Marxist and so he thought in terms of alienation, was that capitalism really starts at the beginning of the Renaissance and the end of the Middle Ages. And unlike the Protestant work ethic theory, he doesn't really believe that changes in religious life created capitalism. He believes that capitalism created changes in religious life, that the emerging capitalist economies of the Low Countries and the UK, what's now the UK, they upset traditional standing social norms associated with feudalism. So they made everyone richer and better off, but they upset people's longstanding status relationships. And when people's status relationships are upset, they get very, very anxious and they start looking for new sources of meaning. Sometimes that shows up in nationalism, which is nationalism really takes off as a phenomenon around that time. Religious fanaticism, you see the Reformation, the rise of Protestantism, a number of other things that happen around the same time. And I think we're going through a similar but less dramatic change right now with what we call globalization, which is making everyone richer and better off. It's making a better world in almost every measurable kind of way. But there are people who are upset and made anxious by it, particularly American workers in the middle and sort of lower end of the skill and education distribution who now have to compete much more directly with lower wage workers overseas than they used to. And you see things like shortening corporate life expectancies, where in the 1950s, a member of the Dow Jones, you know, top 100 companies would typically be around for about 80 years. Now the average corporate life expectancy is something like 17 years. So this thing of, you know, getting out of high school or college and having one job at a big organization for the rest of your life and being taken care of and looked after in that way has gone away. And I think this makes people really very, very quite anxious, even though they are getting better off.
By the same token, Fromm, Hayek, and certainly William White were critical of those, of the post-war mega corporation. And, you know, for libertarians and conservatives at National Review, I mean, it's always fascinating. They worried about big government kind of destroying the individual. Fromm and White, White's more complicated, but it's more the mega corporation, the mega organization is destroying individualism.
Right. Well, in a sense, we've now got the worst of both, right? Mm-hmm. Where we've got the corporate culture still, but we no longer have the security that's associated with it. So people bounce from one big organization to another over the course of a career, or their lives are in some ways dominated by these big organizations, whether it's a university or a local government or other sorts of things, but without the fixedness that was associated with those things. So yeah, Hayek particularly is interesting on this. I think that you know, he writes about the need for an essentially financially independent class of people because it makes it easier for them to be intellectually and culturally independent as well. And they can engage in various kinds of experimentation with ways of living and modes of consumption and other sorts of things. And that they have the resources to do that. Mm-hmm. And that if they fail, things aren't too terrible for them because they're already wealthy. And he worries, writing in the 1950s and 1960s, I guess, that the decline of that class and the rise of sort of middle management, your Thomas, your William White, rather, organization man, will bring with him to politics that culture of uniformity and homogeneity.
Yeah. And this is
sort of very process driven, you know, here's what the rule book says and here's how we have to go.
At one point in the book, you talk about, and you know, it's funny, people of a certain age all know this, but there are fewer of us of a certain age. Yes. But you talk about, say, the corporate culture of IBM
is
paradigmatic. Explain what it meant to be, you know, an IBM employee or a salesman or a sales representative, say in the 50s and 60s, as it exemplifies the kind of organization mentality.
Yeah, IBM went so far as to specify the color of shirts that their employees wore to work, which were white, of course. So part of this has to do with the extraordinary prestige that attached itself to science in the 20th century and the end of the 19th century, which was certainly well-deserved. But there was an idea that we were going to be able to have a kind of rational model of life. And on the left, this manifested itself in socialism, the idea of, you know, scientific socialism and central planning. But on the right, it was, you know, Frederick Taylor and efficiency experts and NASA and IBM and big companies like that were going to work together and solve the world's problems through this kind of rationalistic and necessarily bureaucratic model of doing things. And there are certain kinds of people who thrive in bureaucratic cultures and certain kinds of people who don't. I don't think you or I, either one of us, is particularly well-suited to a bureaucratic culture, but that's our great loss, I suppose, in life. And Hayek worried that this would become sort of the default social position, that these would be the most influential people in society. And they would come to dominate the class of people he called secondhand dealers and ideas, who were not original philosophers coming up with new ideas, but the people who propagate kind of norms and visions and intellectual currents. And I think he was right about that. I think we've really got to the place where the culture of the corporate HR department, which is now what used to be the corporate of the college campus, the culture of the college campus, rather, which is, you know, college man is corporation man in larval form.
Right.
That's become the default thing that you have to satisfy to participate in economic life. And that if you were not politically and socially acceptable to Caitlin down in HR, then you're not going to be able to work. Trotsky, in one of his critiques of Stalin, had an interesting point on this, where he wrote that, you know, the old model of socialism was that he who does not work does not eat. But in a situation in which you have essentially a single employer, it's he who does not obey does not eat. And the idea of a single employer was something that Trotsky shared with Hayek. They both worried about this in the context of socialism. What our kind of social media radicals.
This is, you're creating like a variation on rock and roll heaven, where it's like, you know, Trotsky, yes. Eric Fromm, Hayek, yeah, and William White hanging out.
And the Marquis de Sade on drums.
So, but okay, so.
So we don't, what I was going to finish though, is we don't have a situation in which we have a single employer or the threat of an emerging single employer. But what we have is this kind of unified corporate culture that causes all these various employers to behave in roughly the same way. And it's driven by hysteria, it's driven by fear, it's driven by conformism. But it's also driven by, I think, a genuine dislike for disruptive figures. You know, you go to Silicon Valley, everyone talks about disruption. But ask that, you know, poor dumbass at Google how much these people really value disruption. Right. If you actually are disruptive to the organization, you will be expelled. And partly that is because corporations and our employers have really taken on an odd role in our lives, where they're not just our source of income, but also a source of status and meaning, and increasing that is where life is lived and where social life is shared, is in the realm of corporations, both as employers and providers of public spaces and public goods. So it's become a really, really strangely complicated thing.
Yeah, you write that the individual, the smallest minority, is a constant source of conflict in large organizations. So, you know, essentially what you're arguing is that that mid kind of century or post-war organization man mentality has now shown up in our kind of public discourse. And you know this as somebody who's critical of Donald Trump from time to time. His followers are fanatical, insisters on orthodoxy and devotion to the great man. There's a left-wing version of it. How do you deal with the intervening, what about the 60s and 70s and even the 80s, where their whole thing was they were throwing off the yoke of the corporate culture.
Yeah.
And you're getting, you know, the necktie was a noose. We get rid of that and we start wearing dashikis or, you know, or ponchos or something like that. What happened to that period of, you know, what Tom Wolfe called, you know, the third great awakening or the me decade, where everybody at every level of society was starting to dress however they wanted, to live however they wanted, et cetera. Where did that go to die? Because it does seem like it happened, but we're not witnessing that right now.
Yeah, I think that the immediate post-war era contained, among other things, a really, really unusual set of economic conditions in which the United States essentially was alone among major world industrial powers and not having been more or less destroyed by the war. So most of Europe was a smoking ruin. Its workforce was literally decimated in some places, some places worse than literally decimated. Countries like Japan had just, been nuked, among other things. And so the United States in 1949, I guess, has something like more than half of the world's surviving extant non-military industrial production capacity. So that immediate post-war era is a very odd period in our time. And people look back on it with a great deal of nostalgia and say, why can't we go back to that? Well, we can. All we have to have is a ruinous war in which millions of people die. And most of the world is reduced to rubble. We don't obviously want, but that period was never intended to last. But I think while it did, it gave people a great deal of confidence to engage in various kinds of social experimentation. One of the things I just didn't really have room to get into in the book, that maybe I'll write about it at some other point, is a lot of this you can see if you really look at the history of gay culture in America and gay rights, where in the 70s and 80s, it is this, you know, kind of very flamboyant assertive culture that very, very quickly, just almost overnight, turns into this, you know, Will and Grace button down Chamber of Commerce sort of thing. And who's that guy? Dale Peck, I guess, who wrote that essay over the New Republic that's going to get somebody fired, probably. I think that's, you know, is a good example of that, where I didn't particularly care for the essay that he wrote. I didn't think it was very good. But I think
it's this was a critique of Pete Buttigieg for being a kind of bourgeois gay man.
Right, yeah, for being, you know, the wrong kind of gay man, I suppose. For being the sort of gay man I'm talking about here, the sort of, you know, coat and tie, married.
Road scholar.
Yeah, rather than, you know, your Stonewall rioters and that sort of thing. And I think it's very difficult for people like him, particularly for members of, you know, social and political minorities or sexual minorities, to speak freely, because I think the kind of conformism that we're seeing is much, much more intense in those communities. So if you're, you know, if you're a gay person with views that are somehow, or just a style of writing or style of expressing yourself that is at odds with what's demanded right now, it's very difficult, I think, for people to be able to really, truly, freely express themselves.
And you see that in Ayanna Pressley, the representative from Massachusetts, who recently said, if you're a brown person coming to, you know, to politics, we want you to speak in a brown voice. Yeah. And if not, don't show up.
I don't even know what that means, but...
Well, we do know what it means, right? Well, you're supposed to be woke in a particular way, or you're a representative of a particular group, and there's a script you're supposed to follow.
Yeah, the weird thing is that brown voice belongs to a white guy called Beto O'Rourke, you know, who is, I guess, going to be end up being the spokesman for this particularly abject and craven way of being in public. Yeah, so I think that the forces of that kind of intellectual conformism are much harder on, you know, people who are not able to, you know, sustain their lives through starting arguments with people and writing about them. There's a lot of other ways to make a living, a lot of other ways to be a citizen, a lot of other ways to try to get by in the world. And this is much harder on those people than it is on people like me.
What is to be done then? Because, I mean, essentially the book argues, and I think it documents extremely thoroughly, that there is, you know, a real sense of conformity in at least public discourse and expectations, both at kind of like in a kind of corporate HR culture and colleges and these large institutions, certainly on social media, places like Facebook and Twitter, you get dragged if you are saying the wrong thing for whatever reason. You know, Milton's Lucifer is one of your heroes, is one of the heroes of the book. But what do you do?
I thought about dedicating the book to him, but I thought that dedicating a book to Lucifer might be read the wrong way.
You know, especially for a Regnery book. I'm just thinking like a conservative press would be like,
Milton's
good. But what has to change, or how do you affect change? We know that the answer is more individualism and the idea of letting people having a greater tolerance for divergence of opinions, right? But how do you get there?
Yeah, I think that these kinds of hysterias play themselves out naturally. Mm-hmm. A lot of this is entertainment for people. This is a fun thing for people to do, to, you know, be part of these sort of chanting mobs and that sort of thing. I don't understand why it's fun for people to do, but I understand that it is fun for people to do. And but they get bored with it eventually, I think. People begin to rediscover the value of writers and thinkers, or just friends in their lives, who are not predictable people, who are not go-along, get-along types. People start going back and they start reading, I don't know, Hunter Thompson and Tom Wolfe or P.J. O'Rourke or people like that, and see what it's like to have a mind and a social position that really is free in some ways, that really is hard to pin down, and where people aren't subjecting themselves to being a member of a team and saying, and this is what you were getting with the Trump people, you know, my team, right or wrong. And a lot of this comes from that kind of politics, too, where people convince themselves that the other side is so evil and that we're so close to being, you know, two tweets away from the Holocaust, or we're about to have a Bolshevik revolution, that anything in defense of their side is justifiable and any criticism of their side is treasonous. So, and of course, the president likes to use the word treason, which is worrisome. That kind of thing, I think, eventually plays itself out, too, because people are dumb. You do have to tell them not to drink shampoo. But they're not so dumb that they don't notice that, you know, okay, I'm on the right, and I may be generally more sympathetic to Republicans than I am to Democrats, and, you know, I'm more pro-free market than I am pro-welfare state. There's a lot of nonsense going on over there too.
So
everyone knows it, and eventually it stinks.
Would you consider yourself a man of the right?
Yeah, you know, funny thing is I quit the Republican Party over Arlen Specter back in like 2006, wow. I guess it was, or something like that, which really seems quaint in retrospect. I peaked early on that one, Nick. I should have held out for a
but
while.
But right now there's, you know, there's a kind of right-wing orthodoxy playing out, or a group saying, you know, that liberal democracy, or the idea of a marketplace of ideas, isn't working for us, and that's actually going to destroy us. So we need to start using the state as an instrument of morality. We need to regulate the, you know, regulate social media as a public utility to make sure Diamond and Silk, you know, get the viewership that they rightly demand and are being denied.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
I think that the newfound enthusiasm among certain Republicans for antitrust law, so long as it's used against corporations they view as being politically rivalrous to them and politically hostile to them, is a very worrisome thing. I think it's a dumb way to go about trying to fix the real and legitimate problems that are presented by businesses like Facebook and Google and to some extent some of the other tech companies. Although I don't like lumping them all in together because I think they're really very different kinds of enterprises. And Facebook, though it's financially a very important company and a very successful enterprise, I don't think it's actually a very important business. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it has the power to shape discourse and culture to the extent that some conservatives think that it does. I think Google is probably a more significant company in the long run, although these things are hard to say. I think that I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that maybe competition is the right way to think about going about this. You know, Facebook does not provide any critical service in life. I haven't used Facebook or any other social media in some time. And my life has not suffered greatly for it, I don't think.
How do you keep up with Justine Sacco, then, who's one of the examples?
Yeah,
she was the first great social shamed
victim
and comes up in the book.
And it's also that I'm glad you mentioned her, because a lot of the stuff's not about politics per se, right? It's about etiquette. And Justine Sacco's great violation was a violation of etiquette, not a violation of political orthodoxies. And etiquette is one of those things that also becomes important, and formality becomes important in new and intense ways when societies are upset and feeling anxious about questions of status. So where questions of status are more open, the reaction to that often is in the form of very strict rules about formality and etiquette. You know, in the Middle Ages and after, you've got rules about who can wear what color clothes and, you know, terms of address that are very ornate and all that. We're getting back to some of that, I think, a kind of weirdly neo-Renaissance way of looking at things.
Just a final question. Several books ago, you wrote a book about how the government was running out of money.
Yeah.
And as a result, things were going to change whether people liked it or not. Yeah. The government is out of money. I mean, it keeps borrowing more and more, but it keeps doing so. Do you see the implosion of the entitlement state happening soon, and or will that help affect the reset that you seem to be looking for in terms of, you know, prizing individualism again?
Yeah, I have, I think, scrupulously avoided putting a timeline on that particular issue, because things can remain irrational for a very, very long time. And I don't, again, you know, I'm a guy whose background is literature and theater. I'm not an economist. But I'm not sure that even our best economists have the forecasting capability that they sometimes think that they have. And an organization like the United States government, associated with something as large and complex as the American economy, which is still, I guess, 22% of world economic output or something like that, is way too complex, I think, to make very good predictions about. That being said, when you've got entitlements and other kinds of liabilities that amount to more than the present net worth of all the assets held by members of the human race, I think it's a fairly safe bet those aren't going to be paid out at real inflation adjusted.
But that's also that's forming some, or informing some of the anxiety
and
worries that lead to this kind of bad behavior of insisting on conformist points of view.
So my position in that book, and in The End Is Near, is, you know, what I describe as short-term pessimism, long-term optimism. I think there are certainly some bumpy places ahead for us, but we also have tremendous resources at our disposal that our forefathers did not have, that people didn't have 25 years ago. We've got a tremendous amount of knowledge, the ability to communicate, just plain old material assets, developments in medicine and science and logistics, which people don't really ever think about, but it's enormously important, that we can really apply things to solve these social problems in a way that's much, much more effective than it used to be. And the tragedy, of course, as I get into in that book, is that so much of that capital is sucked up by things like Medicaid that doesn't really do very much that's very useful. So as those programs decline, which I still think that they will necessarily, it's going to free up a lot of capital and energy and human ingenuity and brain power to approach some of these things in a more productive kind of way, which I think will make people happier and better off and more secure and maybe at that point more willing to be as, if not tolerant, at least calm as they should be.
Final question, who is, who's the individual, who is your spirit animal as an individualist, as a free thinker, as a heterodox thinker?
I've got a lot of them. One of the things I admire most in life is people who, through their lives, do something that I have not always been good at, which is to actually really exhibit the courage of their convictions and the way they live. So if you take someone like Dorothy Day, I mean, her politics are as opposite from mine as they could be, but she's someone I admired enormously, that kind of commitment to a particular vision of the world and taking personal responsibility for her role in that, I think is a greatly admirable thing, irrespective of the particular content of one's politics. So those sorts of things, those sorts of lives, I find inspiring.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Kevin Williamson of National Review. His latest book is The Smallest Minority, Independent Thinking in the Age of Mob Politics. Kevin, thanks for talking.
Thanks, Nick.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts on. And if you have a chance, rate and review us. Let us know how we're doing.